Thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this free podcast from Celtic Underground. You can subscribe and like and listen to your podcast wherever you pick up your podcast feed. You can also subscribe at theCelticUnderground.substack.com, where you will get email notification of new content as soon as it is out. And you can subscribe for free, or there'll be plenty of free content, articles and podcasts. But also, you can pay a small subscription and you'll get extra special content. Anyway, enough of me. On to today's free podcast. I'm joined now by Ross Hall, and Ross and I have been speaking quite a bit before we came on this podcast, so for poor Ross, he'll probably end up feeling as though he's repeating half of what we've just discussed, but I will let him introduce himself, but to help that, I'm going to say, Ross, what was your first Celtic game? What was your first Celtic hero? You've not told me this, you've just said it's a not straightforward, bog-standard route, so tell me about your how you arrived at supporting Celtic.
So my route to supporting Celtic, as you say, is definitely not bog standard. I don't come from a Celtic supporting family. As you'll tell by the accent, I don't come from Glasgow. Some people wouldn't even tell you that I come from Scotland, given the accent, but I am from Edinburgh. And my journey to supporting Celtic was literally, my family are all Hearts fans. All season ticket holders, all absolutely love Hearts. Went to primary school. My first ever football game I attended was with my uncle. It was Hearts against Aberdeen, and he said it was the worst game of his life because all I'd done was sat on the radio telling him the scores of Stalybridge against, you know, Leighton Orient or something like that. And he pointed and said, which scarf do you want? I pointed at the red and white one, which infuriated him because obviously that was Aberdeen. And then from there, I think they lost interest in my interest in football. Got a little bit older, loved playing, and my best friend at primary school was a South African lad called Sean. His parents had lived in Glasgow before they emigrated to South Africa and then subsequently moved back to Edinburgh, and they were massive Celtic fans. And that was literally my introduction, as my little best friend. I'd have been about 5-6 years old, and his family were Celtic daft. And so from that point, that was me. And then got a little bit older, Sean and his family moved back to South Africa, and he left me a Celtic top. And that's where it began. And that was it for me. So ever since then, that has been me.
So that's that would have been what, about family. 87, 88, something like that?
By the time Sean left, that'd have been about 88, 89. Right, that would have been quite a time ago.
Yeah, so just after the centenary season, but just as we were starting to go into a really fallow period. So that must have been great to try and start to support Celtic during that time.
Yeah, I suppose I have to remember I was a kid. So to me, Celtic was a couple of players that I really liked.
Yeah.
The Hoops. That, you know, there was no understanding of what was going on. I always laugh when someone asks me, even now, what team do you support if I say Celtic? So it's your glory hunt and whatever. I'm like, when I started supporting Celtic, Hearts and Hibs were coming above us. So, you know, that is not something that you can stick on me. And so, yeah, for me, it was a few of the players. It was the strip. And there was no real understanding of it, if that makes sense. The understanding of being a Celtic supporter came as I probably hit my sort of 12, 13, became a teenager and kind of fully immersed myself in everything. And, you know, to that point, it was always just I loved football and you had to have a team. And that was my team. And it was a very simplistic reason, as that was my best friend and he left me a strip. And love listening to his dad talk about it, because I don't remember the conversations with his dad because I was wee, but his dad was super passionate about it. And I think I vaguely remember saying about, like, his dad or Sean's granddad had seen the Lisbon Lions and things like that. And, you know, hearing them talk about it, it's one of those things. I actually was talking to a friend, big Celtic fan, before I came on tonight. And we were talking about his boy wanting to get into football. And I was like, football, it's not about knowing all the skills and being brilliant at a young age. It's just loving it.
Yeah.
And if people talk to you about it in a positive sense, and that's what Sean and his family did, you'll be drawn to it. It'll be natural. And I suppose for many Celtic supporters who will listen to this and yourself, it's maybe your parents, and it's that positivity that they feed towards you that will drive you towards that. And I was lucky I had that, not from my family, thank God. Supporting Hearts or Hibs would have been a miserable life. But I got that from someone else. And I'll forever be thankful for that, because, you know, ups and downs of supporting Celtic, everybody will know it's not always a lovely journey as it is just now. But yeah, that was my step into it. And then obviously those years where I did start to understand, and it was probably Tommy Burns era that I fully sort of got to grips with, and obviously cup final loss to Inverness and things like that. It was probably the first time I ever cried as a kid watching a game. And then obviously Tommy Burns comes along and sort of changes that direction. Fergus, obviously, a big part of that. So yeah, the tide started to turn, and you know, now we enjoy it for what it is now. Never-ending glory. It's lovely.
Yeah, so that's how you... So based on that, and if your family are Hibs or Hearts, it would have been quite a while before you actually got to see Celtic in person, I would have thought. Yeah.
So I suffer because my uncle Mark, who is the big Hearts fan who took me to Hearts Aberdeen, took me mm-hmm. to a Hearts Celtic game at Tynecastle. It was when there was terrace, and
mm-hmm.
horrible, horrible experience, traumatising. They had me up on the sort of bars within the terrace, and,
yep.
mm-hmm. and it was to watch Hearts play Celtic. And obviously, as you alluded to, at that period, we were not very good. I think Hearts beat us maybe 2-3-1, and I was just, it was bitter disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anything about that game other than the fact it was squeezed against these bars, we're on the terrace, and that we got beat. And every time I've ever been to Tynecastle since to see Celtic play, whether it's been home end or away end, we get beat. So I do not go to Tynecastle because I'm a Jonah. And I firmly believe that, to the point where my uncle would happily have me go to a Celtic Hearts game at Tynecastle because he knows that I'm a Jonah for us as well. So, but I don't remember that game very well. So my first proper Celtic game, home experience, actually wasn't even a home experience. It was Hampden. And it would have been Tommy Burns' first season, I think, was the Hampden mm-hmm. season.
Yeah.
Pretty sure that was mm-hmm. his first season. My dad is a Hibs fan.
Mm-hmm.
And so Celtic were playing Hibs, and it was close to the start of the season. It was August, September time. I remember it was quite a nice day. He was a Hibs fan. Obviously, he was starting to encourage me, even though he didn't like the fact that I supported Celtic. You know, your family want you to be a Hearts fan. Your dad wants you another. The complications that come with that. But by that point, I was happy. This was my team. So he took me to see Celtic play Hibs at Hampden. And the reason it'll always stick out to me is not because I particularly remember the game all that well. I remember the goals, but I remember that he was really irked by the fact that we signed Pat McGinley. And he wasn't irked because we signed Pat McGinley and he thought Pat McGinley was this phenomenal player.
Yeah.
He was annoyed because he used to place a £10 bet on Pat McGinley to be the first goal scorer for Hibs most weeks. And Pat McGinley at that time mm-hmm. generally got a sort of 15 goals a season
yeah,
for Hibs.
Yeah.
So he made a wee bit of money off of that. So when he signed for Celtic, he wasn't very impressed. And Pat McGinley played for us that day because I remember the sort of, you know, that's Pat McGinley and so on. And we won 2-0. And I don't remember too much about the game, but I remember the two goals because it was two of my favourite players at the time. It was Phil O'Donnell, who mm-hmm. scored the first one for the edge of the box. And I was literally just to the left. I can't remember what stand it was, but it was in the main stand. I think it was still left-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And I was almost in line with O'Donnell when he hit. And I don't think it was a great goal. I think it went almost straight through Leighton. And then, great, brilliant. And then John Collins scored in the second half. And it was away at the far end. And I don't remember that goal too well, but I remember we had had a, it was a nice bit of play,
mm-hmm.
but it's that far away and you're
yeah,
smaller.
Yeah, Hampden, yeah,
I don't nice. Remember how he finished it. I just remember he scored, and I loved John Collins at the time. So that was a brilliant experience. But if I remember, I don't remember it being... I remember my dad being really excited. They had Kevin Harper at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin Harper at that time was, you know, hot property. He's incredibly fast. And the only other thing I remember about that game, and I can't remember who played in central defence for Saturday, but Kevin Harper gave him a horrible, horrible time because I remember Harper going close numerous times and Gordon Marshall was in goals. And the only reason I remember that is because Gordon Marshall had a hairdresser's in Haymarket in Edinburgh that was notoriously bad, and you see Gordon Marshall's haircuts over the year, they were notoriously bad, as well as his goalkeeping. So that is kind of my recollection of that game. There's not a lot else to it.
Yeah.
I remember, but that was my first game, and we won, so I was obviously delighted. Dad, not so much, but, you know, stuff him.
Well, they support Habs, so...
Yeah, well, exactly. That's a lifetime of misery in itself.
Yeah, so that's your Celtic stuff, but the reason we got you on is to do with scouting and football analytics and all of that sort of chat.
Yeah.
You've got a blog, and we'll have some links to that. You can give people the name of the blog, actually, if you want.
It's very simple. It's just footballtalentreports.co.uk.
So
read it if you want a good bedtime story. I hope it's better than that, but, you know, worst case scenario.
So you've got that blog, and you've been doing some looking, and you've written online about players that Celtic could be interested in. So the next question is, how did you get into having a liking for that and feeling that you had an aptitude for that?
Again, I'll keep it as short as I can. When I was younger, probably 12, 13, and as I say, I started to really sort of grow into not just loving Celtic, but I've always just loved football.
Mm-hmm.
Every moment, whether it was playing and having a kick about with the bigger guys at the back and, you know, being hammered into walls by guys with shoulder barges when tackles were proper tackles, through to teenage years and, you know, video games, FIFA, and probably Football Manager or Championship Manager and things like that. And I just loved it all. Football magazines, anything football related, I kind of was into. I loved Football Italia on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Then Sky came along, and as much as I'm not going to make a big loving moment for Sky, but Sky, in terms of football, for someone like me, was brilliant, because regardless of what people think of how football, especially Scottish football, is portrayed, they brought insights to supporters that you just never would have got off a Scotsport on a Sunday, Jerry McNee and things like that. And that, every bit of that just resonated with me. So whether it was La Liga or whether it was late night games in Argentina on Channel 5 when it launched, sadly, mm-hmm. I'm old enough to remember that. All that, it literally just anything football-wise, no matter where it was in the world, if it was available to me, I was interested, and not just interested, but was genuinely passionate about it. So I suppose the shortest version I'd give of this is, at high school, there was a bit of a geek in me, in the sense of my friends would give me a player's name from anywhere in the world, and I had to tell them who he played for, what position he played, and anything that I could about them. And it got to the point where they used to try and trick me. Their favourite one would be to stay up late at night and find a player in Argentina at 2 a.m, give me his name, not realising that I'd stayed up, watched that game, and, you know, was perfectly aware of who he was and what he could do. Or their other favourite was Paul Ritchie, because there was a Paul Ritchie at Hamilton who was a striker, and there was Paul Ritchie at Hearts, who subsequently played for Rangers, who was the defender. So they'd say, Paul Ritchie. And if I said one or the other, it would be, oh, well, you failed. But I'd be like, no, he plays for Hamilton. There's one that plays for Hearts. Which one do you want, sort of thing? And it's always been like that. To the point where I asked my guidance teacher at high school, like, how do you become a football scout? But as we discussed beforehand, during that time, it kind of wasn't really a big thing. Mm-hmm. It was just guys walking around parks in trench coats, which would be something totally different nowadays.
Yes, exactly. You get arrested for being an old-fashioned scout now.
Exactly, yeah. And my guidance teacher at the time just looked at me and went, oh, I don't have a clue. And, you know, as a young lad, I was kind of like, oh, well, she doesn't know. How the hell am I meant to know?
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't immersed in terms of football. I didn't really know anybody who was within the game. I had a few friends who played at good levels when they were younger, but there was no adult at that point that I knew that was within the game to sort of give me that guidance. Obviously, years and years went by. Still always loved it. Still took an interest in anything that would come my way, but just never had that in. And then how did we get to this point? This podcast is a big part of how we got to this point. And, you know, it'll sound a bit cheesy since I'm on something that he is so regularly on, but I owe him a great deal of thanks. Because throughout that period of teenage years to adult life where I'd done a ton of other different things, nothing sports related whatsoever, it was all finance and various other bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. But message boards online, and we'd post different bits and pieces about various players.
Yeah.
And lots of really nice feedback, and gradually I sort of added a wee bit more depth to what I was writing, because initially it was just a bit of fun. It was like, oh, these players would be good for Celtic, and, you know, a little blog about sort of. Kyogo was one of the early ones, about 2 years before he signed for Celtic, and that was purely off reading an interview with Iniesta, and someone had asked him a question, which players in Japan do you think would be able to transition into Europe and be successful? And he talked about how he thought Kyogo was brilliant, loved his energy, loved his abilities, technical, mental, just a glowing report of a player. Read that, watched some YouTube highlights, and added his name on a post online. And as I say, that gradually built up. And then various people contact me and was just like, you should be doing more with us. And circumstances in life changed dramatically for me. I'd made a move in my career that didn't quite work out. COVID came. I had a very big conversation with my wife at that time to go, you know, this is what I truly love. And it's huge risk. Huge, huge risk for me at this point in my life to go, I want to immerse myself in this. I discovered different pathways through the SFA, the courses, you know, PFSA, the English FA, all these different courses, and was just like, can I take this period of time, and we put a little time limit on it, and we're not there yet, thankfully, and go, I want to immerse myself in this, but also in that part of the deal is I have two young children, so they become my life, they become my career along with this. And with encouragement, a lovely lady, Cheryl, who I've never met and never spoken to in real life, but people like them coming to me and saying, you know, we enjoy this, we think this is for you, really pushed me to that pathway, and having that conversation with my wife and going, you know, these people who do not know me from Adam believe in me. I'm not even sure at that point I believed in me, but it was enough of a kick to get me going. And mm-hmm. here we are. And, you know, there's the website, there's working for Stennis Muir, mm-hmm. which I love. It's very different. It's, you know, it's not quite as razzmatazz as watching players playing in the Champions League and things like that, but I love it. I love going out to games and, you know, experiencing all that and learning from all the different guys, whether it be on the courses or learning from the guys who are at Stennis Muir, some who are on a similar path to me, trying to make their way in and further up the game. Every part of it just is like, you know, thank God I attempted this. Even if I fail now, I think I'd be happy just for the fact that, actually, I'll take that back. I can't fail now because I've achieved something that I never thought I would. So everything from here is a positive and is something for me to look back on and go, I achieved something. Whether I get to the point where I'd really like to achieve, time will tell. But I would never have done this. And I think you'd said earlier on when we were talking before we started recording to say about your friend who said sometimes you need that moment that mm-hmm. you get to the edge of the cliff and it's what will push you over. I had that moment, and I was just really, really lucky that I have a absolutely wonderful wife, to be fair, because she could have easily said no danger, you know. I wasn't giving up hundreds of thousands of pounds a year, but I was giving up a decent salary that made life very, very comfortable for us. And we had two young children, and we'd recently bought a house, and, you know, we had all the things that go with life, a mortgage, cars, all those bits and pieces. And to go, let me phase back some of that, especially on my end, and give me this opportunity to do this. If she'd have said no, I could have totally understood, and we'd have respected that because, you know, we'd just started a family. But for her to say yes and to give me the freedom to go at this, like, you know, it's mind-blowing for me. and I'll appreciate that for the rest of my days. But having other people in the background to give me that kick to be able to have that conversation, yeah, I'll be forever thankful to them as well.
Are there many clubs of Steny size who's got scout? I've never really thought about clubs at Steny size having scouts and data analysts or anything like that.
Do they all have
people, or is it just random?
I can't speak for them all, but my experience is most clubs have, whether it be volunteers or people that they have on a retainer of some kind, or whether it's just the expenses, whatever it may be, most clubs have people. If you were going to LinkedIn, you would regularly find clubs of all sizes asking for volunteers to help with, whether it be analytics or whether it be scouting or, whatever it might be that they're looking for. They will offer apprenticeships and various other bits and pieces. So most clubs will have it. To what extent and how deep it goes, whether they are just looking for boots on the ground, so like St. Caddick's, I have a good friend who works for them. They have scouts that go out and, cover games for them, do their reports.
Somebody tells me that they are really chucking cash at stuff that's much bigger than some of the lower leagues of Scottish,
I don't know how much, in terms of financial, I don't know how much it costs them. I don't know who they pay what. I know that they have a very ambitious setup there. And so for that, I have to give them great credit. I know that their manager does a lot of stuff with the Scotland youth teams. And I believe he's got a group around him. I believe he was from what I'm told, I don't know him personally, I've never met him. But from what I'm told, he was a very promising player in his younger years and had an injury that kind of took that pathway away. And then invested his time into going into management. And I believe he's very highly rated. I know a few of my Celtic sporting friends pay a bit of attention to what they're doing. But they have an analyst. They have scouts. And Stenish Muir have got analysts. They've got scouts. Director of operations there, Martin, is a great guy. He's been brilliant for me. And he is director of operations, stroke head of recruitment. He has smaller clubs will have people who will have one title but have 10 jobs, really.
Yeah.
And whether that's on a part-time or full-time basis. It varies across the board, but I would say almost all teams in the professional tiers of Scottish football, and even so full-time, part-time, will have people out and about. But some will surprise you. Some of the teams as to how they recruit, especially the first teams, might not have scouts. They might have their manager who will have contacts and, the age-old little black book. And they will put more emphasis on that, so they don't want to have a lot of time. Or they maybe just don't have the time, actually, to spend too much time on scouting reports and all the other different pieces. Because, as I say, they will have the job of being the manager of that club, but will be managing a multitude of things, and so they will put more reliance on their contacts and their own knowledge. One that I'd give great credit for that, and he deserves great credit for it, and he's been at Celtic, is John McGlynnock Falkirk. He, to my knowledge, doesn't have a big scouting department, if at all. He is, from what I'm told, just uses his knowledge and his contacts and puts trust in people. He actually has a lot of ex-Celtic players at Falkirk. I don't know if anybody has actually noticed that, but Aidan Nesbitt, Calvin Miller, I think there's a few others there, and guys that he'd maybe heard of from Hearts. So, they've got a great recruitment system at the moment because they've given trust to John, and John has made good decisions, and it's paying off for them, and they're playing great football. So, as I say, it varies from club to club, but that's an example that's something that people wouldn't expect, but it works for that club. So it's it varies.
So someone that I know, their son, who's 15, 16, continually identifies players, young up-and-coming players, that when then he then runs past someone in a decent recruitment position, they go, yeah, he is a decent player, right? And it's all from playing FIFA, right?
Don't knock it.
I was going to say, so my perception as someone who's just played a bit of Championship Football Manager, stuff like that, but it was really, you know, it has evolved massively since I was doing it. My perception is there's a breed of young people out there who are football stat obsessed.
Yes.
As a consequence of FIFA. Mm-hmm. And therefore my perception of those people is that it's just they've just gone too far in that they play FIFA so much that they almost think real life's like FIFA. Nothing and therefore like everything just involves sitting in front of a screen analysing statistics and you can pick a team based purely on statistics. And so my perception is I see them online and I may be misjudging because obviously I'm reading in 240 characters in a Twitter thing. So obviously it's abbreviated down and they're not putting their whole life. But my thoughts are, and I suppose that's where you then start to almost get like a culture war between older fans and younger fans, and that younger fans use all this XG, XA and use all these stats.
Mm-hmm.
And older fans are sitting there going, stats smacks. You need to look at a player. So who's right, who's wrong? Is there a middle ground? Am I wrong in my perception that there's a whole raft of people who think they can get into football without ever having watched a game of football?
Your perception is not wrong in people who believe that, that if they were to just look at a spreadsheet that they would be able to pick your team of 11 players and be successful. That is their opinion. They're very much entitled to it. At the same time, as you say, you have, I wouldn't say it's an older generation, but you have a generation of people or a group of people who believe you just need to watch them and stats can go out the window because I suppose they don't understand them, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not for me to judge, but I sit in the middle. I believe it's both. I believe that stats have a place and they're great for narrowing down certain things, but I also believe you've got eyes in your head, a brain in your head, and going and looking at a player will paint the picture that you need. Because if I used FIFA as an example, if I said to you, right, okay, this player has got 88 pace, what does that mean? It doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
It's just a number. It's if I said to you, oh, you know, this player's got an XG of over the season 16. Well, for anybody who doesn't understand, XG is expected goals. So that means that that player, in layman's terms, science has determined that they should have scored 16 goals. If that player scores 9 goals, does that make him a bad player? If he scores 29 goals and he's only got an XG of 16, does that make him an amazing player? Or is he lucky?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know if you've never went and watched him, how do you know? And that would be my question to anybody who says stats is the defining moment. How do you know? What have you learned about that player? Have you watched how he warms up? Have you watched how he interacts with his teammates? Have you watched how he reacts to the crowd, good or bad? Especially, you know, if we wanted to pull this towards Celtic, we are an extremely unique club. One of the most unique on the planet. And I say that with no disrespect to any other sort of teams. But we're a club where every time they set foot on that pitch, especially with the environment that we're in Scotland, they are expected to win. And not just win, perform and win.
Mm-hmm.
Every season, every game, you know, whether it's even in the Champions League, there's maybe an element of realism when the Champions League comes in. There's like a sort of, we're probably going to get cuffed. But on the day of a game, if you went outside South Park and went, what's the score going to be tonight? I would say 90% of people would tell you we're going to win. There's that innate thing because we win so often.
Every single Champions League game 2-1.
Yeah.
On the day of the game.
Yeah, it was like Scotland going to the Euros. We were going to beat Germany. John McGinn was going to score in the last minute. There is that innate thing.
I knew that wouldn't happen because he's got a backside the size of my garage. But anyway, But see, I can watch a player and I can see a guy who will not, I can't see him ever performing at the elite level. Because he doesn't have the athleticism of a player. That's just my eyes doing it.
For a period of time, Eden Hazard done it and he had a backside. So it's, it could go in a multitude of ways, but we all have that innate belief. It's like that sort of thing that goes, but we could, even when we know, you know, when we're playing Real Madrid and various other teams in recent years, you have that thing that goes, we're going to win.
Well, so I need to introduce you to St. Anthony, however, he goes the other way. You should be in a WhatsApp group with him. If you went back and looked at the halftime WhatsApp, mate, and he's probably listening to this, so I don't have an issue, because I see this to his face. If you went back and looked at the halftime WhatsApp, you would think we've averaged fifth place in the table every season for the last 20 years. Anyway,
he's not alone in that, I'm sure. Like, you know, you only need to look at any message board to find that exact same experience. I'm probably guilty of that. I think everybody has that thing. It's in the heat of a moment in a game that it becomes quite extreme. It's either one or the other. You have the eternal optimist. We're 3-0 down. Oh, we'll be fine. We'll recover in the second half. And you have the others who are doom and gloom. And this is going to be, you know, 3-7 or whatever.
You see, I must be that. My reply to him was always, a game lasts 90 minutes.
Or 100 these days. But yeah, it's... I suppose going back to point is, if we laid that spreadsheet out, where in that spreadsheet does it tell you how a player reacts to that? And at Celtic, it is very unique. Because how do you react to every week knowing that you cannot rest, you cannot, you know, your standards cannot slip. But if they do, it's merciless. Even when we win, if we don't win well, there's always we won, but this wasn't good enough. There's no sort of half measures. There's an expectation, there's a style of football, there's everything that goes with it. And, you know, I don't know if we're going to talk about the Celtic team as a whole as it stands right now, but if you wanted the perfect example of just sheer will to win, we have numerous of them. Callum McGregor, James Forrest, you know, these guys year on year have done it time and time again, and somehow it's never got boring for them. Because as football players, you know, they're playing the same teams fairly regularly, time and time again. You know, you come up against Rangers, not just maybe 4 times a season, but sometimes 5 or 6 if you're in the cup. Mm-hmm. So over the Callum McGregor's the last 10 years, they had their period that they were away on their wee journey, lovely. But in general, he will have played most of these Scottish teams 60, 70 times in that period. So to maintain that level of intensity and that mentality to say, I'm going to go again, and I still want to win, and that crowd, I need to please them every weekend, to me is mind-blowing. And so if I was looking at stats, where do I see that in stats about a player that I think that guy reacts well when the pressure's on? There's nothing on a stat sheet will tell you that. You could maybe say, right, well, we'll look at games where he played against good teams or at tough away grounds, and oh, you know, his stats are high in those games and he's performed well. But then you've got to follow on and say, well, what happened the next week? Did he have a come down from that, or did he maintain it? And there's so many complexities that, to me, stats give you good guides and good indicators, but the biggest thing is the person, the player. What is he? What makes him? You know, Joe Hart recently, he came to Celtic. I wouldn't have bet on him being a success. I absolutely love him now. I could literally, it's like Henrik Larsson, I could sit and listen to Joe Hart talk about Celtic all night, because that is a person who his stats on the way into Celtic would not have read well.
Mm-hmm.
But as a person, he fitted and he got it and he was excellent and he embraced it. You would never have got that from a stat sheet. You'd have got that he barely played, that in his time in Italy he'd had a lot of errors. You know, he said himself about his manager at Spurs, Nuno, saying that he just didn't think he had it anymore. And a lot of fans and a lot of people who would have looked at the data around him and looked at where he was would have just said, no, not a chance. But then there's the person. There's how does he react when he's up against it, when he's up against the wall. And that is a guy who is the epitome of just a fighter. And as much as I say, I appreciate the stats and I use them a fair bit as a guide to sort of narrow down players who are doing well, and you can sort of build up your own metrics of what you want a player to be. But it's the person. It'll always be the person for me. It'll be, do you look at them and do you believe in them? Do you believe that the stats translate to what you're watching on the pitch? Does he sort of meet the criteria of what it is that you're looking for? What is it your manager's looking for? So if, in an instance, if it was fed back to me that Gary Naismith is obviously the manager at Stanishmere, one of the first things that was said to me at Stanishmere is, you want good players, but you want good people. You want people that, you know, Roy Keane's always famous for. You want people you'd go to war with. You would never, there's nothing on a stat sheet that says that. So, sounds like I've really downtrodden on stats. But I just think they are brilliant indicators. They help guide you to a certain point. But that point becomes the scout or the manager or whoever meeting that player and going, I feel that you're going to be able to do this job. I feel that you have the passion for it. I feel that you're going to understand what is being asked of you, what this club is. And as I say, Celtic is very unique in that sort of, in the bigger picture, is there's maybe three or four clubs in the world that have the demand that we have. Fair enough, our league is not to the same standard as Real Madrid and things like that. But even Real Madrid probably get away with having more bad games than we do sometimes within the league, because they have such a big competition with Barcelona and to an extent Atletico Madrid. But we are quite unique in the sense of, I think only in the last 10, 15 years, there's maybe been four or five clubs in the whole of Europe who have had the levels of success we've had in terms of league titles. There's been us, Juventus, Bayern Munich, and offhand, I think it's Ludogorets. And there's another somewhere in Eastern Europe. It's a very small and unique environment. And
yeah, I mean,
you know, there's a lot that goes with it.
Within that, the sort of principle of that, I always felt was the challenge for when Gary Hooper was going to be leaving Celtic. Mm. And I always thought, the problem for Gary Hooper is, Gary Hooper is a great player playing for a team like Celtic who are playing 75% of the game is taking place in the final third.
Yeah.
And that suits him. Therefore, he will be successful for a team who plays 75% of football in the final third. The problem is he's not good enough to play for one of the top six English Premiership teams. Mm. Therefore, if he leaves Celtic, he's going to go to a team in the bottom half of the and this is what happened, in the bottom half of the Premiership,
yeah,
who are not playing football where he needs it to be played, he will then not look very good. And so I sometimes think not only are we unique, but uniquely a player can succeed here at Celtic when he wouldn't be able to, because those unique circumstances that fit with him, mm. he wouldn't be able to succeed elsewhere. I mean, unless Gary Hooper had actually left Celtic to go to a team that was at the top of the Championship, would he then be playing? But the problem is he'd then be playing slightly beneath himself. So he was in a bit of a limbo of he was too good for that, but not good enough for the elites. And
yeah, it's, at that point, it really comes down to the player. Mm-hmm. So whatever the pathway is that they choose, you have to look and you have to know yourself, I suppose. So I understood at the time why Gary Hooper done what he did. You know, people thought England, and I can't remember if it was the Euros or whatever it was, and there was a feeling that if he went down south and was successful, and, you know, you have to appreciate the fact that he's looked at a situation and he's believed in himself, and he's thought, I can go to Norwich and I will score, you know, 10 goals. And if I score 10 goals in that Norwich team, I'm going to get recognition. But as you say, that Norwich team, unfortunately for him, was not very good. You're lucky if they created 10 chances that season, never mind mm-hmm. give him the opportunity to score 10 goals. I think they actually only scored 27 goals or something. It was mid-20s that season. I think they scored in goals over a whole season. So, you know, it was not going to be a good move in that regard. But he had that belief. And I'll never ever knock a person who has that belief in themselves. As we say, to get to this journey, I have to have that belief in myself that I can...
Absolutely, and if you don't believe in yourself, nobody else will. So, yeah. I mean, again, that's what, you know, somebody said to me Why was, when Fraser Foster came back and then left again, why did he leave to go second choice at Southampton? Was it Southampton he went to? Yeah.
Fraser left and went, yeah, Southampton.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody said to me, why did he go to become second choice at Southampton? And I said, because he didn't leave to become second choice at Southampton.
No.
He believes that when he goes there, he'll become first choice. And it's the reason why he then went to Spurs, because he believes in himself that he will be able to get, if he got an opportunity, he'd be able to do it. And that's what these people believe. On to the stats stuff. So one of the things that I often think, I remember I always go on about reading Soccernomics, because it was the first book that I read that thought that that was saying everything I'd, you know, you're thinking, wow, yeah, this is speaking directly to me about all the things that were wrong in football. You know, it's now about 15, 20 years old, so a lot of it's moved on from that. One of its things was talking about centre-halves.
Yeah.
And it was talking about how at elite sport and elite football, actually, there's not that, in some ways, there's not that much of a technical difference between a player in the top tier of English football and the player in the third tier of English football. The issue then becomes the marginal benefit differences start to become in their head.
Yeah.
And that how they cope under pressure. So getting back to your point a bit. And so they use the example of a centre-half, two centre-halves pass the ball between each other in a third tier English team, have got the same pass completion rate and control as a as two centre-halves doing it in the Premiership.
Yeah.
But once under pressure, that's when it starts to crack. And I don't know stats well enough to know. So if I was to only be reading stats, are stats telling me that that centre-half's brilliant pass completion rate and whatever is because that team is continually playing against opposition who sit back and have the modern terminology I believe the kids use is low block, and they're sitting back and they're letting those centre-halves pass backwards and forwards, so they're never actually passing under great pressure, so they've got great pass completion rate because actually they're not under pressure when they're passing. So I'm not sure if the stats go into that level of detail of what is the game conditions like when those essential dribble moments and sprint moments and pass completion and reception, receiving and is it given that level of information that you can get without having to go to a game?
And what I have access to, no.
Right.
Stenhouse Muir's a little bit of a world away from, you know, if you went to probably the most well-known examples at the moment are probably Brighton and Brentford. Now, Brighton have created their own data model that they have, and it's within the group that Tony Bloom, the teams that he has, so Union Saint-Gilloise in Belgium and things like that, they probably do. They will probably break it down to the point where they will say passes received under pressure, and they will go that in depth. If you go on something like Y-Scout, or if you go into one that I use is a new one, just because it's a personal thing, so it's DataMB, they will not go to that level. So at that point, if you're just using those tools, again, if you wanted to see what that pass completion, how that comes about, you would need to watch the game. And then you also have the other factor that, and again, we discussed this off air, and this is, you know, this is coming from players that have spoken about this. One of our ex-players, Aidan McGeady, spoke about this. You have players who are quite conscious of the fact that managers and coaches like stats, that they will come off the pitch and, you know, I don't know if Gavin Strachan has this live on his laptop, but, you know, he gets jokingly called Laptop Gav for a reason. So even his dad makes jokes about him and his laptop. But if you get into the end of the game, whether it's youth players or whether it's professional players, they are conscious of the fact that coaches are seeing these things. And Aidan McGeady done an interview where he talked about how players at the end of the game were conscious of that. And so at the end of the game, they might make a few easier passes, or they might just throw in an extra wee sprint or two just to get their numbers up. If you're reading the stat sheet, again, and I'm not dissing on stats because I feel like I am by saying this, but the eye test is how you see that. Am I looking at a player at the end of the game going, boys, passing all game has been miserable. You know, out at the corners and things like that. But then I come off and I go into Y-Scout the morning after and I look at the game and I go, he's got 80% pass completion. Right. Last 10 minutes of the game, they were under no pressure, as the example you've painted there. Yeah, there was a few passes between him and the centre half, and they weren't doing anything. There was no pressure coming. The game was, you know, the game was dead. Nothing's happening. That's how he got to 80%. But for the 70, 80 minutes before that, I've watched him shank them into the stands, and or he's completed passes, but they've been behind players, or they've been, you know, the player has had to really exert himself to get on the end. It's not been a good pass. It's successful because the player's got there. But how that's broken down at the elite level, I would assume there probably is a way. I know that the methods that the likes of Brighton and things like that are unbelievable. I'd love to sit and look at them one day. But for most clubs who will use Y-Scout and StatsBomb and things like that, that data is a little bit harder to pull out of what you get. It's effectively a spreadsheet. And, you know, they'll paint it in pretty graphs and radar charts and, you know, they'll plot things and things like that. But
I like my numbers and I like my stats. Can I just say those radar charts that I see with, it's like a spider's web thing.
Yeah.
It's a, honestly, somebody, people keep putting them up on Twitter and go, look at this player that Celtic might be interested in. And they stare at them and I go, very good. Mm. That looks to me like I've read the tea bags and the tea leaves rather, and the tea. I mean, I just don't, it's interesting. Give me the stats and I can pull stuff out. Do those things which are supposed to be visual stuff, supposed to help people. I just don't get it. I don't see it.
It's the same again. I think there is a value in it. So Kasper Schmeichel, probably a good example recently. People were quite quick to go online and go, this is his radar chart from last season. And it showed you things like he was in the, you know, the 95th percentile for shot-stopping last season and things like that. If you looked at the sort of top leagues across Europe, if you wanted to throw Belgium into that, he was the top shot-stopper in Belgium. And those charts and things like that will break that down for you. It's the same again. I like that in the sense of it's a nice direction towards what he's been doing. But then if I went and watched the Belgian League, and thankfully I'd seen a fair bit of it last season, if a lot of those shots had just been straight at him, I'm going, you're saving them all day. And if you aren't, then, you know, we're in trouble. Barkas, on the flip side, is the opposite of that. Barkas had great stats when he came to Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
But circumstances were very different, COVID and things like that. And I do believe a big part of being a successful player within a club is how you integrate within a club and how the club integrates, takes you in. Something I believe, from what I'm told, Celtic are quite good at, that Callum McGregor and the likes of James Forrest are very good at trying to help that. But in that situation, that was a very unique season. And it hindered us in a great many ways. But on a personal level, for someone like Barkas, he came in, had come off a really good season at AEK. There was nothing to suggest that he was in any way a big concern, or that there should have been any concerns about him, especially if you looked at his stats. His stats were pretty good. But then you see what happened. It's a personal thing. It's the person. It's how does he react to the situation. And it was, you know, for him, it was bad. He's since left. He's actually doing all right. He's over in Holland. He's at Utrecht. And not amazing. If you were to look at his stats,
I can see people online chucking his stats up.
His stats are relatively decent just now. But Brendan Rodgers made this comment recently, actually, about Mikey Johnston. And he's a hot topic amongst Celtic fans of how heavy a shirt is. And Brendan made the comment, I think, when Mikey was at West Brom, and said, you can have a great player, brilliant player. And from what I've read about Mikey and from all the comments of all the coaches that have ever had him and the players that have played around, they all talk about his ability is second to none. But Brendan made a comment about sometimes it is the weight of a jersey. And our jersey is heavy. And in that regard, you know, talking about the pressures.
And it's sometimes heavier for homegrown
players. Yeah, definitely. It's a horrible balance, I think, for homegrown players, because it's people really want to see them succeed. There's a bigger investment, I think, in a way that sometimes manifests itself in an incredibly negative way when it doesn't go well. And I think that balance of how players manage that, again, I would never, ever speak for anybody. But I know from a personal level, if you put me in that environment, I would melt. I'd be a quivering wreck, hiding in the corner of the pitch, going, "I've had a mare here, and this lot are baying for blood." That, for me, would break me. So I have immense respect for these young guys, but it has to take its toll. And so I understand that when Brendan talks about, you know, how heavy that jersey is, it's the same as being the manager. It's a heavy, heavy weight that'll take its toll on all these guys. So whether the, you know, it's the coaches, whether it's the young players, in some ways it's probably easier for guys who have come from abroad. For someone like Barkas, he's just like, "I'm getting criticised here." He'll know in himself, "I'm having a mare here. Like, this is not going well. Just get me out." But it doesn't make him a bad goalkeeper. It was just wrong environment, wrong circumstances. It doesn't make him crap, which would have been the thing that everybody would say, "Oh, he's crap. He's, you know, chucking whatever expletive that you want." He's not a bad goalkeeper. You don't play at the level that he did by being crap. And he's went away to Holland, and he's playing for a team where, you know, there's a little bit more luxury of getting away with odd thing that his ability, you know, needs to let him away with. And he'll go on and do fine. You know, he'll make a career out of the game.
So you said earlier about you were sounded like you were running down stats and babbling stats. And as you're talking away, I was thinking of people that I know who might go, "See, stats are a complete waste of time. You need to see a player." But it's actually Barkas an example of why stats do matter. Because if you went to see Barkas at Celtic, you go, "He's rubbish." But you would look at his stats and you might go, "His stats before Celtic were good." And perhaps if you're considering, you know, when we'd sent him out on loan, and his stats on loan are good. There's just this window at Celtic where I've seen him most, where he looks poor. And his stats are not massively poor. And is that maybe where stats can help you go, so maybe it's not, maybe it's just he was in the wrong movie. He's at the wrong club. It just doesn't, everything, he's at the wrong town, the wrong club. It just doesn't fit for him. Because if you look at the underlying stats behind this guy and you take that wee 3/4 of a season he played at Celtic, because it ended up being that, out, his underlying stats are okay. He's the right keeper for us. Is that where stats do work, do you think?
Same again. I just think entirely it is a balance. So what you've said there is absolutely right, in the sense of you will have players who will be at clubs and their stats will be amazing, and they will make a move to a bigger club and their stats will be okay, but it just doesn't work. And there are so many different factors. It's, you know, I try to always think it, and I hate saying that a player is rubbish or crap, or it doesn't sit well with me. There are a few that I do think are, but I don't like sort of that being my default reaction to anybody, because I think if you took any person from any walk of life and moved them to a different place, a different town, different city, can be in the same country, and you change their environment, then that takes time to adapt it. And some people will adapt better than others. You know, it's the goldfish out of the bowl and into the sea. Well, you know, it's not going to survive. It's how long it takes people to adapt. So we would look at Celtic and we'd look at someone like Burnaby. Burnaby came. Burnaby's stats were all right. Burnaby as a player, if you looked at him for the period around about 2 to 3 months before he joined Celtic, had a real hot streak, and his stats during that hot streak were amazing. You're rolling your eyes because I think you probably know me, but there is. But what I would say is, if you watch Burnaby and you looked at what, if I went on Y Scout and I looked at Burnaby, I'd go, you know, for the last couple of months, if I was looking at that period of time, good player. It says he's a left back. I'd watched Burnaby before he came to us. He was never a left back, he was a wing back. And he'd done it quite well for that period of time. But if you went back a little bit further, you'd have went, well, these are a lot of red flags. These are concerns, his defensive position. And, you know, people love to talk about Greg Taylor and his height. Well, Burnaby's height, he's smaller than Greg, I think. And so you're looking at all these things and you're going, there's a lot of red flags here. So
I think he's smaller than Grumpy and Dopey and Snoozy. And
so using the Barkash reference, that as well, if you took that hot streak out of Barnaby's history, what you'd have found in and around that wasn't very good. So it can go a multitude of ways. And I think the reason I would say I think Brighton are a brilliant example of stats working is because they would be the first to admit they use them to the highest degree of probably any club. But it is not the end decision that is made based on those stats. It is an indicator to drill down on what they value as a club in terms of what they think each player should have and how that's represented as a number. And then they will drill down that list to still in the hundreds. And then they will start looking through those players and highlighting them and going, and then it becomes eye test. And then it's like,
yeah, so my perception of
monitoring from that point where they've drilled down to a point, but at that point it stops. It's continually monitored, but it doesn't make a final decision. It then becomes, right, let's go and find out what this player is like. Let's go and watch him. Let's go and investigate his background. Let's look at his education. Let's look at, you know, his lifestyle. Let's look at everything.
So my perception, if I was running the scouting system at Celtic, for example, the 7 billion people on the planet, right? And then within those 7 billion people, there's however many hundreds of thousands of people play football.
Yeah.
And I've got, and everybody that I'm competing with has got a choice to pick a player from those hundreds of thousands. Then you've got at the very, very elite level, they are picking the very elite players, right? So I'm not getting them. But I want the tier of player as close to that most elite level as I can afford to get. So what I'm going to use the stats is to, as quickly as possible, bring to my attention people whose stats are sitting there at a good level, but they are below the elite player level and they are at a level that I can afford. That's what I'm wanting them to bring to my attention, so that I'm then honing it, getting back to the Brighton example you were given. So I'm finessing it and honing it and honing it down to, right, I think that's it. And then that's the point when I'm wanting humans to go and look at the players, because I've then finessed it. I've used the numbers to help me quickly. Otherwise, it will take me forever to find players because I'm having to look at too many games. I'm using these numbers to drill it down to a small group that I can then get my guys out to go and look at. And then that's why question I've asked at an AGM, I've asked this question a number of times and I never get it answered because I know the answer and I know why they don't give me the answer. How many boots on the ground have we got in the key locations where the main talent and the price band and the ability that we are looking for, how many boots on the ground have we got to then find out what those people are like as people, as you've just identified? So you're picking a player, a shot, you're looking at a guy who's had a burst of activity, but he's down in Argentina, for example. Yep. So do you have someone in Argentina who can tell you, what's his lifestyle like? Does this player actually dedicate himself 24/7 to be an athlete? Or has he just gone through a wee burst and he's been successful? But actually, running up to that, he's been a bit of a pain in the backside because he likes a baby and he's a bit of a disruptive person. And I'm trying to get that rounded picture of him as well, because that will be an indication, your point about, I'm picking this guy up and I'm moving him from, in that example, that I'm just randomly picking with no connection to any player, you know, people might be listening. Taking him from South America, from Argentina, and taking him the other hemisphere and dropping him in a completely alien culture. If this is a guy that his personality's not right, he's really going to have a difficulty coming to. It's not like we've got a famous expat Argentinian. If I pick just a random player, I'm not thinking of anyone in particular. If we've not got an expat random population in Glasgow of Argentinians, he's going to find it difficult to settle. If I then find out he's not got a great personality, can easily go off the rails, I'm thinking he's maybe not the best person to bring halfway across the planet. Is that the type of mix that you're...
I think, like, again, sort of going back to something that we spoke about previously, I could listen to people win football all day. And one of the best examples of bad recruitment that I ever heard, and he never named a name, was listening to an interview with Jurgen Klopp. And I think, same again, if you want to look at good examples of recruitment in recent years, not just at the top end of the team, but at the bottom end through the academies, Liverpool is right now unbelievable. Jurgen Klopp said, he was asked the question, have you ever regretted signing anybody? And as I say, he never named a player, but I think he said at a time he was managing in Germany, and he said, we got this player in, and he said his method was, you know, they'd have the meeting with the player and within the club and whatnot. He said he invited the player to his home, and he met with the player, and he was chatting to him, and he was just like, what are you into? Like, what do you do when training's finished? What do you do? And the guy went, I go home. I sleep. And he went, but, you know, any other drink, are you into cars, are you into, you know, whatever? And he went, and the guy went, I go home and I chill and I sleep. And that was kind of it. And Klopp went, this is a fabulous, fabulous player. He went, talented beyond belief. He went, sign him. And he went, worst decision he ever made. He went, because that player, as talented as he was, didn't fit in anywhere. And so he had a real problem integrating. And part of that integration is being able to express yourself with your teammates, with your manager, your coaching staff, with the people in the club. And he went, this guy just had nothing really going on within his life. And he said, that's actually a big red flag. He went, because you want these guys to integrate. You want them to get on well. Again, I like the fact that Celtic at the moment, you see Instagram pictures, you know, there's groups of players that are out and about with each other, that they holiday together and things like that. That is a huge, huge part of it, because, you know, I came from working in finance. My old boss was always big on the, you need to get on well with your teammates and your workmates, because you spend more time with them than you do with your family at home and things like that. And he was like, you know, it's a cliched thing. He went, but you do. And with football players, they're travelling, you know, sometimes huge distances together, you know, the breakfast with each other, lunch. Then they go home to their lives and they do whatever. But I think, you know, we talked about certain things again beforehand about how other sports, what they have has been integrated with the football. NFL is a big, big one, especially with the amount of Americans coming into clubs. One of the things that I love about American sports and American recruitment within sports is they look into greater depth, not necessarily into stats, although their stats are unbelievable, the depth that they look at, but they have the luxury of getting to look, especially within the draft system, the player's education. You know, they make big efforts to go and meet the player and the family and get a full picture of what that person is. NFL, much like football, has its fair share of, for want of a better word, BAMs. You know, they have the players who are a bit off the edge and, you know, shooting each other and things like O.J. Simpson, whatever. You'll always get the odd one, but the effort that they look into that background is phenomenal. And so it's that measurement of talent and then everything else that makes up, it's a person. You know, it's you have your business. When you employ someone, you look at them and you go, right, they're brilliant at what they do. Their CV is impeccable. They have got brilliant stats. They have, you know, they've sold stuff off the charts or whatever it may be. But it's a person. And you have to be able to engage with that person, relate to them, you know, understand them. Same again, see interviews. Jason McAteer talked about how he hated Graham Souness when he played for him because Souness did not understand a personal situation in his life that was incredibly important to him. He said years later, I mean, Souness got on really well. Souness apologised to him. He went, I was a manager, a lot of stress. He went, but looking at your situation, it was, I think it was deaths in his family or his in-laws or something like that. And he went, it was very instant. He went, Souness just did not engage with that at all. It was, get yourself in, you're playing tomorrow. That's a human. That's a guy, yeah. You know, and that's a very extreme example, but, you know, it's, to me, I think if you ask me my ideal situation as a scout, or if I had to go and sit with a manager and go, this is where I'd be like, I can tell you he's the best player in the world. Until you meet him, I can't, you know, or until we invest time in getting to know the person, whether that means investigating their the background of social medias and things like that, and then going deeper, and a manager having a real conversation, a genuine conversation, which is difficult because some agents don't like that conversation to happen because that can reveal certain things about players that they perceive as weakness. But if you want to get the best out of a person, that relationship needs to work. And if you don't know those things, then it's more risk. It's a bigger gamble. So again, if you were saying, let's take a player from South America, we don't know his lifestyle. We don't know what makes him tick. We don't know how he got to that point. Then it's hard to get him in and go, we can carry on that journey and continue to get that development from him if we never knew how he got there in the first place. It's just, throw a dart at a dartboard and hope for the best. So my emphasis is, and again, I feel like I've repeated myself 100 times, but my emphasis would be, stats will get you to so far. Go and see if what you see in terms of stats equates to what you're seeing on the pitch. So the passing and things like that. You know, is his 80% pass rate because he's making loads of simple passes? Is he making, a lot of good decisions? They'll have things like passes into the final third, which is obviously more difficult than passes, short passes in defence, things like that. And they do break down those things, but it's everything else that goes around it. It's how do you get to those points? And wanting to see, to me, it's visual. I want to see a picture in my head. I want to be able to leave a game and go, I read that guy, he's great. His XG is high. Right, I can understand why that is, because he's great positionally. But he scored less goals than his XG equates to. So his XG is 15, he's only scored 5 goals. But I'm looking and going, he's getting into great positions. If you develop that, and if you have a manager and a coaching staff that are good at developing that, and that, I would like to think as a scout that I would get to know my team well enough where I go, our coaches would get that from. They would take that XG from 5 to 15 and beyond. But at the same time, I then need to go and know that person and know what motivates them. So how do I go to a manager and present a player and go, right, well, this guy's got all the materials, but this is where he needs to go next. How do I know that without, investing time in the person? Some people would argue against that. That's just my personal point of view, is it's the investment in the person and knowing the person and wanting to have that engagement to find out what makes them tick, what makes them develop. And then I look at the people around me and go, have we got the people who can do that? Or has this guy got the bit about him, or women for that matter, when scouting now, because that is a big part of it, is have these people got that bit within them to push on to that next level? And it's fascinating, and I love it because I like engaging with people. So that element to me is big for me. But I also, as I say, I understand people who would go, this guy's got amazing stats, he's in the 95th percentile. Danny Armstrong for Kilmarnock, if you looked at his radar charts this season, his percentiles are amazing. He'd be up there with the likes of Rafael Leao at AC Milan. Obviously, it's different levels. It's Serie A, it's SPFL. But, if you looked at him, it reflects the fact that he did have a great season. I'm not belittling his season, but I'm just saying, the difference. If you looked at stats of Rafael Leao and Danny Armstrong, and you didn't know anything else about them other than those numbers, you'd say, well, Danny Armstrong was the same player as Rafael Leao, and in some cases, slightly better. But we do know more about him. So then, to me, I want to make that investment in that player. If I was going to him, so you're saying sign the very top player, well, we're never going to sign Rafael Leao. But Danny Armstrong, he's doing a lot of good things. He's doing a lot of the right things, and his numbers marry up to it. So what's the next level? Danny Armstrong's a Kilmarnock player. It's a different world being a Kilmarnock player to being a Celtic player. How am I going to find out if he can cope with that? To me, the best way is go and talk to the guy. See how he presents himself, present a picture to him as to how I see him, see if he believes that what I've seen is true, and is he honest enough to reflect back and go, you've seen that, I don't think I'm good at that, or I think I'm better at that than you're saying I am. And develop that relationship and, really, invest in the person. Always invest in the person. I'd put everything that is, use all the other bits to get to a certain point, but at that point, invest in the passion.
The challenge with that, though, is
you have a small window to do it. Yeah.
Correct. That's what I was going to say. The challenge for us as a club, so if we are wanting to get people, you know, very simplistically, we're a player trading club. So in general, we are wanting to get people in, unless we've decided I need an experienced player, Kasper Schmeichel. I need an experienced player in that position. I don't care about his age. I want to experience a guy who's a man who knows how to handle, a grown up, you know, knows how to handle himself. And that's the decision. But in general, as a player trading club, we are wanting to get people that we can then sell on and make money, who will add value to our team on their personal player development journey. So that means we need to be signing people who are under the age of 23, probably under the age of 21, likely to be from Argentina, Brazil, Croatia, you know.
Scandinavia and these places.
The places that the 50 clubs that we haven't, that are likely to buy from a club of our size, and if I got the money to buy clubs from, buy players that we want to sell at a profit, where do they want players from? So we need to identify all. But the problem is, that's where the elite player clubs are shopping as well. So if we want an English Premiership team, we'd spend £30 million on a Brazilian striker who's banging in 30 goals a season for us at 22. Yep. They would spend 30, and he's done it in the Champions League. See, he comes to us, scores 4 Champions League goals and 30 goals in a season, and he's 22 and Brazilian. A Premiership team would go, we're interested in that guy.
Yep.
At the £30 million that Celtic are looking for, this fictitious in the future. But we need to pick him up at 19 or 18. Yep. And that's where the clubs who are buying from us, they're also looking there at the same time. So we need to pick him up before they spot him. So the challenge you've got from your description of, we need to get him to know him as a person to make sure at 18 he can cope with moving, speaking Portuguese, and then suddenly speaking English, and sausage suppers being the staple diet. He needs to be able to cope with that move. How the challenge you've got is that getting to know him thing needs to be done like that.
We would say it needs to be done like that, right? We'd say it's click of the fingers. You might get one meeting with a player. You might get, you know, an hour on the phone with him if you're lucky in certain circumstances. How you get to that point, for me, is never going to happen overnight. It's a build up of relationships with as many people as possible. So I'm going back quite a bit. Eric Black, when he was at Celtic, he was a big part of recruitment. And you know, my recollection is probably different from some others, but I remember at the time that a lot of people talked about Eric Black and the relationships that he had with people literally across the globe, because he had built up good relationships, whether it be with agents or whether it was with scouts or whether it was with emerging academies, whoever it be. And at that point, it is that investment and the time and building that structure that will get you to that point where you can make those snap judgments. You'll never, ever always get them right. That's going to be impossible. There will always be failures. But the more you build up those relationships over time, it is a huge investment of time, and it is a willingness and a desire to engage. And sometimes, with the greatest of respect, and pardon my French, see through the bullshit, because there is a lot of people in football who are full of it, unfortunately. And it isn't always as professional as it should be. But again, that's maybe me coming from a totally different background where, you know, the emphasis is on absolute professionalism at all times. But it's how you create that environment. And there are clubs who do it incredibly well. So it's not impossible. You know, you've got, I used the example of Falkirk earlier on, but if you wanted to use good examples, then clubs to do it. Feyenoord are a great example right now. Bodo Glimt, who pumped us out of the Europa, great example of it. There are teams who can do it. It's not impossible. It is a
So it's doing that system. Thing of one of our unsuccessful signings of last summer. I know someone from the country that we signed that player who was unsuccessful, who said if they just picked up the phone to me or a raft of other people they'd have told you that guy's he's got a reputation for being, and then he told me all the faults in that particular player that was known within the country that we signed him from.
Mm.
So I suppose it's your point of, okay, so we might only get a 1 hour telephone conversation with the player, and he's there with his agent, so it's all very guarded. But you pick up the phone to, you're signing a player from Argentina, and you are friendly with it, and you built up a relationship with the director at River Plate, and you phone up and you go, or wherever, we're interested in this player. I know he doesn't play for you. Can you give me some feedback on him?
I can give you a really good example, and nobody's going to shoot me for this because this player is no longer in Scotland, and he was the first player I ever scouted, and it wasn't for Stenishmir, so nobody's going to shoot me for this, and he didn't sign for the team that I was scouting him for. A player called Naya Joseph, who had been through the youth system, I think, at Rangers. He had been around sort of various teams in Scotland on loan, and he ended up at Albion Rovers under Sandy Clark. And the day I went to see him, he was the first player I was ever given, this is your assignment, this is the player you're going to go and watch. And he was playing at Celtic B, so that was a nice one for me because I had an interest in going and seeing how that setup was looking. But Naya Joseph, in the week leading up to it, I was going to see that game. By the time I got to that game, I had looked through social media, read fan comments about him. I'd looked at his own social media because it was open. And I then spoke to a few people who had been to see him before and had scouted him previously. I spoke to a few coaches that sort of knew of him, who spoke to people on my behalf and sort of said, what do you think of this guy? And with no disrespect, because I do not know Naya, is that people said he was too obsessed with things outside of it. He was too fussed for fashion and like being a lad and things like that. And you look through his social media and he likes to take his pictures with his car and all his other bits and pieces, like any young guy to me. And my only response back was, has anybody, all these guys have scouted him, has anybody actually got to get to know him on any level or spoke to coaches who work with him? And they're like, no. I was like, anybody spoke to Sandy Clark or attempted to speak? Because Sandy had him at two teams. So I was like, Sandy's had him for a reason and he's taken him to Albion for a reason. He's then made him captain of Albion for a reason. Now, I don't know what those reasons are. If you don't ask anybody that's got that information, you're never going to know why. So you're making these judgments about this young guy because, he's got a nice car and he's, he wears the gear, whatever. And he likes to post on his Instagram in his spare time that, he's at whatever restaurant or he's doing whatever. I believe he's now actually playing out in Australia, maybe, somewhere like that. He's trialling out for a team over there. To me, all I seen was a young guy who had a passion for something outside of football. I didn't see that as a negative, but that's me. But this perception that other people had built up and it had sort of snowballed into this thing of, he's not fast. Have any of you asked? Have any of you spoken to, the coaches? No, there's just, we've heard, and it's like, from who? Like, if you're going to tell me something about a player, at least make it sure that there's a very close point of contact as to where that information came from, because there needs to be something behind it that you'd put your hat on and say, right, that's my reason for liking or having concerns, or this is the red flag. It needs to be legitimate, because I think it's one of those where if you just looked at the perception of someone and people talking about them, they could tell you anything about anybody. We've all got reputations online. If you went online onto the huddle board or whatever and you read about me, one set of people would probably call me an arsehole and the other would tell you that I'm some sort of scouting genius. It's probably somewhere in between, I thought. But yeah, that would be my investment. And as I say, it takes time. I was quite lucky. I was taught a lot about talent ID by two people who had been at Celtic, John Stevenson and Robert Doherty. Two fabulous guys, a great deal of time for. And John Stevenson always said to me, he's like, he went within recruitment and he has worked at a lot of clubs. He's like, you're always trying to work about a year, maybe 2 years ahead. And he went, and it's that investment in time and working out what your strategy is and then really drilling down to the point where you're you'll never be 100% certain. It's just not possible. The best coaches in the world are never 100% certain. But he's like, you drill it down to the point where you're confident and that you're willing to say yes. And you go for that. And he went, how you go about that? Everybody will do it in an individual way. You know, we've talked on and off about data and good, bad. Some people will do it because they believe in the data. That's fine. If they're willing to hang their hat on that, that's fine. For me, it would be, do I believe in the people? Do I believe in the information I've got? Am I confident where it's come from? Am I confident that I've done my research? Am I confident in the data, the stats? And am I confident in what my own brain and eyes have told me when I've watched that player? And the hugest part of that is building those relationships with people, building, going and meeting coaches, going and meeting other scouts, being willing to be open and engaged. Some people are very closed, and that's fine. Some people don't want to, you know, they feel like they're holding on to golden nuggets. But it's a big, wide world when it comes to players out there. You could go onto YouTube, and you'll have all these different channels with scouting videos, and they'll show you these little clips with the awful music, making out that every player's the next, you know, Messi or Pele or whatever. You can watch them, and you'll get good information from them. But then you need to go beyond that, and it's constant. It is just this never-ending source of information. And you're right, when it comes down to it, sometimes that decision will have to be made very quickly. But the more work you have done, the better you'll be at making those decisions. I feel like it sounds mad to say that I absolutely love it. I could sit and watch it all, these guys all night. I'll never come close to making it to playing at that level. Could only have dreamed of playing at that sort of level. But watching these guys and seeing what they put into it to get to that point, the things that they forgo to get to make it to the levels that they do, and then sort of seeing how passionate they are, seeing what makes them tick, or listening to them do their interviews afterwards, as I say, Joe Hart and things like that. That's me. I love all that. It's I suppose it's a bit like trying to live your dreams through other people in some sort of mad way. But to get to that point, it's the relationships. It's building them. It takes time. It's why I think, you know, Celtic in recent years, I think we've tried to do a lot of the right things. I don't think anybody at the club is trying to do the wrong things at all. It is just everybody has a slightly different approach. So last summer, for example, some people would portray that as a horrible window. It wasn't a horrible window to me. It was just there was a miscalculation in terms of every manager will have a set of player profiles, player avatars, whatever they want to reference it as. They will have a list of things that they want from each player. To me, the only problem last summer was we got a lot of players who all fitted kind of one avatar and ignored other parts of the game, like the experience of winning things. So we signed Palma, Holm, Lagerbielke, and Naraki.
Juan.
Yang.
Bernardo.
Off the top of my brain, Bernardo might have won things at Benfica and youth level. None of them had won a proper league title. I don't know if any of them had won a cup, but none of them had won a proper league title. Lagerbielke went close because his team came second. None of them had played overly in Europe. None of them had passed the 100-game mark at professional level. Nat Phillips, who came from Liverpool, hadn't passed the 100-game mark. I think he actually hit his 100th start at Celtic. Now, he was a 26-year-old guy at that point. But it was all those guys had all those things in common, and it was just maybe, in my opinion, too much inexperience at one time. It wasn't a load of bad players, because some of them are good players. I think Luis Palma is a player that, in the right circumstances, will do quite well, whether that'll be for Celtic or, you know, whether it's a situation like Barkas where he'd maybe have to move elsewhere to show what he's got. Luis Palma is a good player. It's just, for me, a lot of it was inexperience and also maybe too many players with a view to what they might be able to offer as opposed to what they were. And they weren't bad players. They were good players for what they did for the clubs that they played for and the circumstances that they were within. So Naraki, played in the back three at Legia. The two central defenders next to him were quite experienced guys. I think both late 20s, early 30s. Hundreds of games between them. He played in that three-man defence. He was allowed to move up and press the game and not worry so much about what was behind him, because he had these two guys behind him who were experienced and who could help talk him through that game. He came to Celtic, much like Lagerbielke, who had a similar partnership but in a four but played deeper. They came to Celtic, and then all of a sudden Carter Vickers was injured. The defence was a mishmash of players, and Rodgers, to me, would have been having nightmares at night trying to work out what he was going to set up, because it was forever changing due to injuries. And we were putting these two guys in, and there was nobody really there to kind of control that situation in the way that Carter Vickers did. Scales has come into the equation and kind of managed himself through that really well, in my opinion, well above expectations. But it was, yeah, a lot of these inexperienced guys who had never had to really be in that position where they'd had to lead a situation. Odin Holm was the same, hadn't hit 100 games. Played in a team where it got away with a lot of things, and there was a lot of people around him to protect that. And
what my perception of what happened last window was the leaders who were setting out the criteria for what we were looking for. It was almost as if they'd been given the basic rules of how to play the player trading model. Without understanding the rules, without really understanding it. So it was a player by number process. So for example, the big one I continually go at, we play three midfielders effectively, three in the middle.
Yeah.
So barring catastrophic injury, we've got McGregor, Hitati, O'Reilly are our three, right? So barring catastrophic injury, suspension, whatever, at any one time, one of those is out.
Yeah.
So at any one time, we have one vacancy for, if you're buying a player that you're going to develop and you think, he's just marginally below those three at the moment, but he's only 19, and I think with 2 years of first team football, he'll be above those three, right?
Yeah.
So you've got one position to be filled. We then go and sign. Iwata was on loan and gets made a permanent deal.
Mm-hmm.
Holm, Kwon, Bernardo, is that it?
Yeah.
So we sign four midfielders and we have one vacancy for the midfield. Therefore, none of those four are going to get the requisite game time, because at any one time we've only got one of the positions. So it does create two problems. One, either one of them is head and shoulders above the other three and he keeps filling that vacancy, and therefore the other three, we've just pissed the money up against the wall because they are not going to get any game time. Option number two is, they're all much for muchness and the manager can't decide which one, and he ends up playing all four of them at any one time, and therefore none of them are getting any game time. So all of them were a waste of money. Mm-hmm. But the other side of things is, it then prevents the likes of a Kelly coming through, because if we, instead of going out and spending roughly 8 million quid on four players at £2 million each, roughly, and if we'd gone out and bought one £7 million player for that one position,
yeah,
we also are leaving the space that in the event that we get two of them out, we've got an opportunity for one of our academy players to come in.
Yeah.
And so for me, it just looked like, one, it was a conservative, it was actually, contrary to what a lot of people think, it was a conservative decision. It was a hedge your bets decision. Let's look, we buy players who are 18 to 21 and some of them fail. So let's buy four of them thinking you're spreading your bets. When actually what you do by buying four of them is you guarantee failure. Because their fear is, what if we go and buy a £7 million 20-year-old, 19-year-old, and he doesn't make it? We've just blown 7 million quid on one 19-year-old who didn't make it.
Yeah.
My attitude would be, yes, but by spending that same amount of money on four players, you're actually guaranteeing failure. You're baking into the process, at least two, probably three, possibly all four of them will fail just simply through lack of game time because we don't have the vacancies in the three. So that was one of my issues. My other issue is, getting back to the point I made earlier, there's 40 clubs who might buy from Celtic in European football, world football, if we're a trading team, top whack. Top 15 in the English Premiership. You know, if we're wanting to then sell people at a decent profit. Yeah. Top 15 in the English Premiership. Teams, I'm not saying they do, but they are potential to buy from us. Two or three in Germany. One or two in France. Or maybe two or three in France. Three or four in Spain. So that's where it is. They won't buy. They do not spend £30 million, with an exception of one or two in the history of world football. They do not spend £30 million on Koreans.
No.
So don't go and shop in Korea. Don't go and buy a guy from the second division of Korea for $1.5 million because at best you might sell him for three, four. Pointless. He's not massively added to our team and he's not massively giving you profit. So don't buy from that league would be my argument. Don't. Palmer. Again, he's it would be an exception that we would then go and make a massive sell-on profit from him.
With Palmer, and again, I know that the opinion is fairly split on Palmer. What I would say about Palmer is Palmer, in many ways, is like the left-hand-sided Leo Labada. Take everything away from Leo Labada and just purely on performance. Before Leo Labada signed for us, when he played for Tikva in Israel, everybody said he was a right-winger. Leo Labada was never a right winger for Tikva. His starting position was a right winger. Leo Labada's position was fundamentally a striker. He was pretty much always the central guy furthest forward. Everybody talked about, and we go back to the stats, everybody talked about how he was outperforming his XG, and there was people online saying, it's just an anomaly, it's lucky. You know, that won't last. Well, Leo Labada was a good finisher. Lewis Palmer was the equivalent in Greece where his role within, was it Aris? He played on the left side predominantly, but the amount of time that he spent coming into central areas was high. And he was getting a lot of his goals that way. And, you know, goal scoring players will always be deemed as this sort of idea of, if he scores those level of goals for us and he performs to a certain level, you'll make money on him. If you're looking at it as a trading thing, to me, trading thing is for someone else to think about. I would just always look and go, is this guy going to make this team successful? Is he going to be a success both as an individual, and is he going to help the end goal of the team of winning titles, winning games in the Champions League? You know, is this guy going to push us on a wee bit? And so I can understand why people looked at Lewis Palmer and thought, you know, he offers something a wee bit different, especially with the fact that things like shooting for distance. One of the things that I find infuriating about him is you can see all the techniques there. When he strikes a ball, he strikes it as clean as anybody in Scotland, as clean as a lot of players in Europe. He's just not very consistent with it. And, you know, he'll attempt the odd one that'll disappear into the stands or whatever. But I understood the reason why someone would look at him and go, we could do something with him. And if he carries on, and if you were going to the data side, if he carries on his data levels, then you could sell him for a lot of money. But again, I'd go back to where I am and go, he's a young guy. He's moved from Honduras to Greece. He's now come from Greece to Scotland. It's going to take time. It's going to take understanding. And again, I would sort of say, I think you would look at him and go, did the person or group of people look at him and go, we're taking him for what he is, or are we taking him for what he think he could be? And there has to be a balance between that, because you do, with young players, you have to be able to try and predict an element of what they're going to give you in the future. But if you're going to put them in your first team, you need to be confident. And when I put him in tomorrow, am I confident that he does enough for what he is now that he's going to be good enough for us? And I think that was kind of where I would say there was a bit of a mishmash. And I also totally agree with your point of, we signed so many players. There was the wingers. There was, you know, 100 wingers. Tilio, Yang, you know, Kun, Palmer, Maeda, Abada, that, you know, we could have practically fielded a team of them. And they almost get in each other's way. And Rodgers has said as much previously. I think he said in his first stint with us, and I think he said it when he arrived this time, he wants to keep a relatively tight number on the squad. Because one of the luxuries we do not have, and again, I go back to this unique team, Rodgers was one of the quickest to say that once you hit the season, and it's why I'm not concerned about our pre-season or signing players, but pre-season is one of the few luxury times where our manager and coaches get to work with players on a multitude of things, all facets of the game, tactical, technique, their fitness and everything. Whereas when we go into the season, especially through the early part of the season where the Champions League, and it's going to be bigger this season because we've got more games, you've got the League Cup, we are Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, or Sunday, Tuesday, whatever it may be, with three games a week. So you listen to Pep talk about it, you listen to Klopp talk about it, it's basically you have no time to actually develop players in a week when that's happening. It's really hard to find that time because you've got recovery, players constantly carrying little niggles and various bits and pieces, so they've got to manage all that. It is very hard within that space of time where they're training maybe on a, played on a Saturday, they go into training on Monday. They're then travelling on the Tuesday to the Champions League game for the Wednesday. They get a wee session, which is predominantly prep for that game to train. They then are coming back. They've then got recovery. They've then got a session to maybe look at the team that they're going to play on the Saturday or the Sunday. There's very little scope in those windows to go, right, I'm going to pull you aside, Louis, we'll use Palmer as a reference, and we are going to specifically work on this. This is going to be your individual training regime where we're going to look more specifically at your game in these areas. I'm sure they probably do it, but I can imagine it's incredibly hard to manage that because you're trying to create a level of consistency and you're trying to manage, the players physically. And again, I probably keep on saying his name, Callum McGregor, it blows my mind. You look at his games over the last 3 or 4 years, basically since 2022, and they had the Winter World Cup, and you look at how that season was structured and the Champions League and Europe and everything else. Nations League was into like mid-June last summer. So basically through all that period, he has never stopped apart from injury. And even when he got injured last season, they were very open and said they managed it back when probably in an ideal world, they would have let him have a bit more time off, potentially even go and get an operation. Then he went away with Scotland and we're back and, pre-season, we're in the US and off they go again. And so I often wonder, and I don't know, it would be a lovely conversation to have with coaches. It's easier at Stenhouse Muir, they train on a Tuesday and Thursday night, play on a Saturday. But how did the elite level coaches manage that situation of developing individuals? And Rodgers has proven previously with us that he is quite good at it. You've seen how the likes of Stuart Armstrong and things like that came on under him. But it's a very, very, as I say, I just think Celtic is such a unique and unbelievably special. But if you're a player and if you're bringing a player into that environment where they've come from a Sweden, a Norway, a Korea, wherever, and then you go, well, you've got to play Saturday, maybe the odd midweek game, right? Okay. You don't need to win every week. Then you go, it wasn't a huge uproar if you didn't win every week. Right. Turn up here and this is your environment. And that's difficult. And I think I totally agree with what you said, is they made it slightly more difficult, or extremely difficult, because then you've got four players competing for that time to develop. And you've got a manager and coaches going, there's only so much time in the day. The players are only in for so many hours a day. And I've got, instead of maybe four or five first-team midfielders, I've got eight of them. Mm-hmm. And so I totally agree with what you're saying there. It was, in some ways, it was a design that was, I wouldn't say always going to lead to failure, but it was going to make it significantly harder for the manager and for the players. And then you've got the integration in amongst all that as well, because they've got to find their own place within the setup. And that I can only imagine that's very difficult. And as I say, that's why I have absolutely the utmost respect for them, because I think it's a position where I'd love to be. I'd love to have been at Celtic, but I just think we as supporters are all very guilty of forgetting those facets of how you get to that point. And we just go, oh, they train from 10 until 2, and it's a, you know, it's a piece of nonsense. Anybody could do it. Well, you know, if anybody could do it, we'd all be doing it.
Exactly. And the other thing that really, in terms of you were talking about Cal McGregor, just really hit home to me when Rangers went bust, actually, and player contracts, you know, you were coming online. Yeah, there's something you don't really think, you're aware it must happen, but you don't really think it through. They have a holiday entitlement written into their contract.
Yeah.
So within that weekend, midweek, weekend football, and within the fact that they've got loads of, within all of that, a standard holiday entitlement of numbers of days when they are not at training and at has got to be slotted in as well. So in terms of your point of working with players, just basic human elements of these guys need a day off to go to the shops, to spend with their family, to buy some new clothes, buy their new car and go look for a new house and all that. They need some time off to do just basic human stuff.
Yeah. And as I say, it's easy to say, oh, well, they finish it 1 or 2 or whatever. To me, irrelevant. But I think you have all these different facets, and as I say, utmost respect for them and the things that they forgo to be able to do what they do. But you're right, you know, they have to have a life. And I think it's support, and I am guilty of it. I know I've been guilty. You look and you're ranting and raving, going, no, this player's not performing and things like that. They're not putting in enough effort. And it's like, well, how much effort is enough? And who am I to be the person that says that?
And I always use the example of, it was Koeman at Rangers who talked, I remember after he left Rangers, talking about you're playing in Northern Europe and having meal times at certain times of the day. And then you get a phone call, and within 24 hours, you are playing in Spain with meal times at a completely different time of the day and bed patterns at a different time of the day. And you then, your body clock gets used to that. And then you're signed by a club even further north in Europe, Rangers, and you're back to the meal times that you used to do. And football fans expect that you can't, that you're an elite athlete and that you can just flip from different bedtime, different mealtime, do all of that stuff and continue your performance at the same standard, changing from all, just little things like that. I always think. Listen,
my life goes out the window when the clocks change for about a week. I'm hopeless. So I suppose one question I'd ask you, and this is something that I thought about the other day, and it sprung to mind there when you spoke about Callum and that period where he came through, and as I say, they were on their wee journey. We look and we talk about recruitment and things like that, and something that I'm incredibly passionate about and I love is the academy system. I've really enjoyed getting to know about that. I've been very lucky that some of the parents have been very happy to sort of share their experiences with me, invite me up to Lennoxtown and sort of showed me around and talked me through all the young players and things like that. Because I, as I say, it's not just this lovely idea going and getting all these lovely players from here, there and everywhere. Is makes it sound very exotic and very, I don't know, very appealing. But the academy is a big thing for me. And I was looking back over what Celtic have done in recent years, and you were talking about, you know, we signed all these midfielders and that then blocks a Daniel Kelly. You've got Francis Turley coming through, and there's Colby Donovan, the fullback, and some of the others and things like that.
Anderson,
who went to Austria. Actually, one thing I'm going to give Celtic great credit for here, because I don't think this is necessarily known, and it's not a secret. It's not anything that I am privy to that other people are. In recent years, football clubs, from a scout's perspective, and especially, I should probably cover this, so I've started doing some of the coaching badges as well, because I'd like to, I don't want to become a coach, not for me, but I'd like to understand that element. But something Celtic have done very well in the last couple of years with young players is there's been a few players within the young team who've had quite significant injuries. And a lot of clubs would have had them out. Mm-hmm. At the end of the contract, just went, no, like, off you go. There are 2 or 3 that have been given contracts for 1 or 2 from the point of their injury to see them through to the point where they can do their recovery and hopefully get back to cracking on with developing their game. But, and that's something that when I heard that, I was quite chuffed about that. It's as I say, it's quite sad, but it put a smile on my face. But the other part is, going up and seeing the academy players and then looking back at our recent history. And the club have got a thing on the website that talks about, oh, we've X amount of players who've played X amount of international games, things like that. Part of me thinks that's a lot of faff, but never mind, that's aside the point. Because we have all these players and because there's a thirst for sign-ins, the academy players in recent years have struggled to get through. There hasn't been one that's really cemented a place in the team pretty much since Callum or Kieran Tierney.
Kieran Tierney.
But when you look back to when they got in and that they were allowed to be in the team for long periods of time and they were allowed to fail because we had some fairly average seasons, it was Ronnie Dyle.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, not that there wasn't any pressure, but the pressure was not as prevalent as it is today, where, like our Olympic, we have Rangers and, you know, every game is now must win until such point as the title is won. Every cup game is must win until the point where the cup is won. McGregor and Tierney never had that. And to me, I look at that and go, it's off in a totally other tangent direction. For me, I've always been a bigger believer in that the Scottish League should be bigger. There should be more teams. Mm-hmm. There should be less games. I think you should have a balance between the fact that you have teams who come into the season and want to compete for the title, Europe, mid-table, and then relegation. I think with a bigger league, you get that better spread. And I think you would see more scope for development. But going back to Callum and Tierney, if I was to say to you, if they were moved into this team now, where they were back then, with the environment as it is now, do you think that they would have been what they are? Do you think they'd have got the opportunities to be what they are? Because they are, I know Tierney's got his injuries, but they are top tier
exceptional players. I remember being at a fan thing, Ronnie Dyle speaking, somebody said, that any young players coming through? And Ronnie Dyle said, there's one player called Kieran Tierney. He can be as good as he wants to be. He'll reach as high a level as he wants to reach because he's that good. So maybe there's an argument of he was exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
What I look at is, I've not seen him play. Heard lots of good things about Anderson, the left back who went to Austria.
Mm.
We need a left back, right?
Mm.
Now, the whole purpose of sending those players to Austria to try and do our best to make them first team ready. That's why we cleared out the B team with players and sent them in different places. The fans say we need a left back. So I then look at it and go, so how would they react if we don't sign a left back this summer and the manager says, because I think we don't need to because we've got Anderson. I think they'll go off their nut. A sizable number online. Now, different if he then comes into the team and everybody's going, wow, this guy is Kieran. He's the best left back since Kieran Tierney. But the chance of him being able to do that are limited because of the point we were making earlier of people could easily get on his back, not because he deserves people to get on his back, because they're pissed off that he's not a £7 million left back, which is what we want to sign to be able to perform better in Champions League.
Hmm.
And so actually for me, this then does get back to the don't sign four centre-halves, four midfielders principle of, in an ideal world, if Anderson's got a chance of making it, in an ideal world, we don't have Greg Taylor. Because in an ideal world for me, we then say, we think Anderson's got a chance, but I want to have a better left back, but we want to do better in Champions League football in the winter. And I'm not picking on Greg Taylor, I'm just using this as an example.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And so we want a better standard of player than Greg Taylor. So what we're going to do is we're going to sell Greg Taylor back to Kilmarnock and we're going to sign a £7 million left back and Anderson's going to be the backup left back this season. Mm. Now, the risk of doing that obviously is, what if the £7 million guy breaks his leg in the first game and Anderson becomes our first choice left back? And everybody says, what did you sell Greg Taylor for? But for me, that's how that gets back to my point of why I wouldn't have spent £7-8 million on four midfielders last season. I'd have spent £7-8 million on one midfielder and opened the door for Daniel Kelly to come in and to be the fifth, sixth midfielder in the group of midfielders that we want. And for me, that's the, you know, and if you look at Rangers, for example, they sold Nathan Patterson to Everton. In an ideal, if you're looking at it in a proper, how do you develop your team? How do you have a pathway for academy players? And how do you have a player trading model? And all of that type of stuff that we as a club need. In an ideal world, what they should have done was the season they sold Patterson, they should have kept Patterson and sold Tavernier. And Patterson become their... Instead, they sold the guy coming through. So for me... You've got to try, and it's really, really difficult. I appreciate it's dead easy on the sidelines to say, because these are human beings. You kind of just move them around like pawns on a chessboard, and you're out and you're in. But an ideal way that our team develops is, last season we signed one centre midfielder at £7 million, and Daniel Kelly or Turley this season start to come through. Yeah. This summer we sign, ideally, actually, if we are going to sign a left back, and Anderson, and the people, and I don't know, but if they believe Anderson's got a chance, then actually the person to leave the club is Greg Taylor. And you sign a £7 million left back who's better than Greg Taylor, and you say, a bit like, actually, where I think they've got it right, a bit like what they've obviously done with the goalkeeper. They have decided the Finnish guy is going to be our first team goalkeeper in 2 years' time. And it's pretty obvious what's happening here is they've signed Schmeichel. This Finnish guy's going to play the cup games.
Apparently.
Finnish guy's going to play the cup games. Schmeichel's going to bring him through. He's going to play. I mean, unless he's not good enough to do it. But this is the plan. Obviously, best laid plans are mice and men and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That it would be the ideal, that we go out and sign, ideally. I mean, the challenge then is, well, do you then go out and sign a £7 million left back who's 25, because he'll never do, because that's him, he's reached his level, he's plateaued out, and he's probably that, he's probably not massively better than Greg Taylor. Or do you sign a £7 million 21-year-old Croatian left-back, knowing that we're going to sell you, but he's only 18 months older than Anderson. So it is a, and for me, that's why you then have a sporting director at a football club, because he's the guy who has to have these big picture plans, and not football managers who, getting back to your point, have to win the next game on Saturday or Wednesday or Sunday or Thursday. That's why you need a sporting director who plans all of this out, and it also deals with modern football. Now, I have spoken to people inside Celtic. I really believe this time Brendan plans to be here for a long time. You know, he is planning to be for... longer than his current contract. But modern football is, people move on every 2 to 3 years. So having a sporting director, planning out that whole, how you feed young players through, how you give the academy players a pathway, because that's our challenge. One of the reasons we are hemorrhaging the players that are showing any half decency are leaving, is because there's no pathway. Getting back to your point about McGregor, Tierney, they're not seeing a pathway into the first team. We as a club are not offering a pathway for them to develop from being the best 17-year-old in Scotland in that position to 4 years later, we are looking at signing a guy at the same age who plays first-team football for Aberdeen. Why is the Aberdeen guy developed? Because he's got first-team football when patently the fact that the guy's at Celtic means he was better than the guy who's at Aberdeen at the same age group at 17. Otherwise, we'd have the guy who is at Aberdeen, because we just hoover up talent, very simplistically. We hoover up talent, so we get that in. So part of our challenge is giving people a pathway to develop as a player, playing more first-team football. And it's how you balance that out. The Austrian clubbing thing that we did last season, for me, looks like it's given players that. The challenge is, if they then come back to Celtic and we go, good for you, And they find themselves fourth choice left back, there was still never first team football pathway at Celtic.
So it's actually a good example of that. So for the most part, I agree with the majority of what we said. One, I know it's your podcast. I just want to make clear to anybody listening, I don't think he meant that selling Greg Taylor at Kilmarnock was a realistic option.
No, I was just
to be
using
very,
it. I was
very
just
clear.
I was just picking them. I don't think Kilmarnock can afford them.
I could literally just hear from sort of jumping around and sell them to Kilmarnock. How could anyway, there's a good example of what you were discussing there in terms of that development pathway. And so you talked about Sinisalo, who's coming behind Schmeichel. But we actually have this dilemma now. When they signed Sinisalo, if I'm Josh Clark, or if I'm Joe Morrison, or if I'm Luwiemi, I think is the right pronunciation. And again, sorry if I'm totally wrong. Josh Clark went to air last season, done well. Toby was in Austria, but I think was injured for a big chunk of it and kind of only came in towards the end, and you know, a difficult position to come in three quarters of the way through a season. And then there was Joe Morrison, who I think is quite highly rated. I can't say I've seen a lot of Joe, but I've heard good things about him. But Josh Clark was probably the one that I focused on because he done well at Ayr. He went away, obviously, with Scott Brown and Stephen Whitaker at Ayr. And he'd done really well. And he's come back in the summer. And you've got Segrist. Is Segrist actually away yet?
This evening, Celtic announced it about 6
right,
o'clock.
Okay. I was going to say, he's like seemed to just be lurking in the background forever. Obviously, Joe Hart is retired. So, looking at it from Josh Clark's perspective, he's gone, I've went to Ayr. I don't know what the expectations were given to him when he went to Ayr, but he's went away, he's went to Ayr, he's done well. He's come back in. So you've only got Scott Bain left. So is he looking and going, well, I've got a good shot of being number three, fighting for number two? Knowing full well that we were always going to sign a goalkeeper of some kind to be the first team goalkeeper. But Josh Clark's looking and going, I've went away and I've done well. I'm coming back in. But then we've signed two goalkeepers. And as you say, the path behind that is quite clear. Schmeichel's there, Sinisalo is the understudy, waiting for, you know, the Tuesday afternoon shows or League Cup games, as they'll be called. And Josh Clark's gone, well, Scott Bain's still here, and he's just recently signed an extension to his contract. With the greatest of respect, in part probably due to the European regulations about having homegrown players and so on and so forth. But Josh Clark's looking and going, well, I'm a homegrown player, but I'm still fourth choice. And so I agree with you in the sense of, and the same applies to Daniel Kelly and whatever people think of that situation, is if I'm looking at a pathway, and the reason I asked that question about McGregor and Tierney is, since then, we've had a few who have skirted in and around the team, Stephen Welsh, Tony Ralston, but nobody has come in and really cemented anything for a period of time. And so when I'm looking at the academy and I'm looking at the fact that we want to sign players, and that as fans and as supporters, we have expectations that we sign, you know, £5-7 million players. But at what point does there come, at what point does the development come where we'll gurn about the fact that Daniel Kelly is liable to leave and that Rocco Vatta has left? And whatever you think of them as players, or you know, whether you think they were going to be good or average or whatever you think they're going to end up playing for Ayr United in the future. But those young players need that pathway. And that is something that, even though, you know, you brought me on here to talk about recruitment and scouting, one of the biggest things that I would like to think that I would go on to understand, and the reason I started doing the coaching badges, is I want to be able to have a rounded enough knowledge that if I was sat in a club like Celtic and you've got a manager like Brendan Rodgers who's saying, you're right, we need this, I would want to be confident in my abilities as a scout and with my relationships, and I obviously been big on this, is with the staff on the club to go, have we got that in the building that maybe just needs the chance? Because I think a big part of where players have got stuck in recent years, and I think we've had players within the club that could have went on to do quite well, but just the chances never arose, and sometimes timing and a bit of luck is everything. And I referenced this to a friend. There's a wonderful interview where Alex Inglewood, Liverpool's head of recruitment, who'd worked in Spurs when they had Harry Kane. And they said, did you know Harry Kane was going to be as good as he is? arguably world class, definitely, you know, top tier strikers of this generation. And he went, never had a clue. He's like, you were lucky if when he was 15, 16, if he was mid in the range that he was. He went, it was luck. He went, Brad Friedel done a training drill one day where he got the young strikers to come out and do some shooting one. And he went, Brad Friedel came in, sat with the coaches and was like, he shoots like Robbie Fowler. And he went, and all of a sudden, a light went off for the coaches and were like, really? And he's like, yeah, he's got this incredible low-driven shot. He went, it was one thing, one tiny wee thing that changed the perception of Harry Kane. He was like, now, would Harry Kane still become a great player? Who knows? Probably, you know, as you say, but it's opportunity. And it's someone taking the time to see that you think that opportunity is there. And you need your young players to believe that is there. Otherwise, we're selling a load of false hope to all these young guys. So that, you know, Donovan's, Turley's and things like that. Even though as a scout, and as I say, the idea of going and doing recruitment and looking at players all over the world is like a dream to me. But at the same time, I want to be looking at the club that I support and go, these young guys do get a chance at having a future. Because as I say, when we joked about it earlier on with Mikey Johnston, and that there is that balance of criticism, things like that. But I love the idea of these young guys going into that team and being a success, probably more so than signing a player from abroad.
I would like nothing better than Anderson. Actually, nothing again. It sounds like I'm picking a great deal. I'm not, but nothing better than Anderson actually does use up Greg Taylor, because it would also demonstrate that we have a pathway for the player, not just in terms of he got first team football, but we had a strategy for it. We found a club that he could develop in the window between, and you know, 16, 17 year old and first team football, that we found the right club for him to develop as a player. And then that wasn't that the loan move was the first step on his departure. The loan move was the first step on him coming back ready to play first team football. And you can start to show that to people of, actually, this is, you know, if you, and say Donovan does it on the right, and Boson Lawal does it in centre mid. Say within 2-3 years, those three are. And I pick them only because they've been playing in these pre-season games. Say in 2-3 years' time, all three of them are playing first-team football and we are holding our own in Champions League with them playing first-team football. That makes it so much easier to then say, and what we did with their pathway was, when we identified that they were first-team quality players, but they weren't quite ready for our first team, so we put them out on loan. But that loan move was the first step to them becoming a Celtic first team player, whereas in the most of the last decade, with the exception of Callum McGregor, that loan move has been the first step in, we're getting you out the door because there's no space for you here. And that, for me, would be why I would be delighted if those three players, for example, of current ones who are fishing around the first team, could end up succeeding. Because it would demonstrate that we've got that sort of pathway. I've no idea. I've not seen enough of them to know whether they can achieve that. Somebody did say to me, Boson Lawal will have a very good career in professional football, but the next 6 to 9 months will probably determine whether it's at Celtic or somewhere else. Someone who'd watched him.
I think there's many. I think there's some in the under-18s. I'm not plugging my website here, but like I'd written bits about it on my website when I'd done the sort of four-part on Celtic, because I've been up and spent time and watched the under-18s, and you know, we've got a couple of fabulous fullbacks, and there's one of the wingers now, I feel really bad because he had a bad injury, and I've seen him, he's just come back and he was excellent, and oh, this is going to annoy me because I've forgotten his name. Well, we'll come back to me if we ever do this again and we talk specifically about
these players. What I was going to say, because I just noticed the time, we've been chatting for 2 hours, so the poor listeners have done this in 5 different commutes. So
you might want to split this into 2 parts.
Well, we want to talk about Celtic specifically. So what I was going to say is, if we stop this year, because this is a convenient point, if we stop this year and then sometime in the next week, you and I will reconvene. The listeners will get it. We will talk about what your thoughts on the current Celtic squad. Maybe we might have even signed a Belgian-based left winger by that point. Mm-hmm. What you think of the current Celtic squad and what you think of the academy players that might be able to come through.
Mm. Yeah, you could sign me up for 10 hours. I could talk about this all night. One last point I'll make just before we go on, it's purely because I know I will forget, and we've been talking about loans and recruitment. And it'll remind me if I say it now that we'll talk about it maybe next time, is you're saying about the loan market and players going out and that being the end. It is something that the club as a whole needs to look to do better because, and I don't necessarily agree with this, but as a part of world football now is, there's a trading model. The four midfielders that you talked about earlier on, we signed all of them and we brought them into the club. And what will happen to them is anybody's guess. But there is an argument, and it has been seen to be successful with some clubs, and you look at things like multi-club ownership as a negative, and again, whole other conversation. But there is an argument you can sign players and instantly loan them out, and they can still make you money. And a good example of that is Newcastle done it with Josef Minty, who played against us in the Champions League for Feyenoord. They signed him for about £7-8 million from Denmark. Now, I know we're not going to spend that sort of money and then loan a player out, but the idea is there that you can bring a young player in who you see has got a good future, but you know needs to still carry on his development somewhere else. You can send him out. You get that year to look at him. As long as you're happy with the club that he's at, whether that be to Austria or wherever else. And at the end of that season, as long as you're confident he's in a place where you're going to get games, and if he does well, you then have the choice. What am I going to do? Do I want to bring him back because I think he could make an impact? Or has he done that well at a club that I don't think he's necessarily going to work for me, but I can still sell him. And I can still sell him at a profit because of the fact that he's boosted his profile at a club that's at a better standard than where he was and has got enough exposure and he's done well enough. And if it doesn't work, then it is literally like what you said earlier on. It's like having, and I'm not picking on it, it's like having Kwon and saying, right, well, we've sent him out and he's done well, or he's not done well. But we've signed him anyway. So he's either signed him and he sat in the dressing room doing not a lot, sat in the stands most Saturdays doing not a lot, and his value just depreciates. Or you put him out, hoping that he develops into whatever player you want. Or he develops and you sell him, and you end up no worse off for it. To me, it's not ideal because it's hoarding players. I don't necessarily agree with the idea. But just in general, that model is something that has become apparent within world football that is another discussion down the line. But yeah, just so I remember to discuss it, and then it'll maybe come up another time. But listen, I want to just last second say thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've, you know, it's been 2 hours. It feels like it's been 20 minutes, and I apologize if I bored everybody to death. But also again, just to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to engage with yourself and for encouraging me to pursue this, because it's a real pleasure for me. I love it. It's, you know, hopefully I'll carry on doing it for as long as I can, or until the wife forces me back to work.
Well,
thank you. You'll
be on the podcast again the next week or so as we talk about the squad for the coming season. So with that, I will say, Ross Hall, thanks very much.
Thank you, and have a nice week.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground. Rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision. And also subscribe to the CelticUnderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address. And then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine. in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.